Good evening, everyone. My name is Heidi Reitmeier. I'm a curator here at Tate Britain. Before I say a few words, can I just ask that everyone check to see if your mobile phones are off? That'd be great. I'd like to welcome you to the last of this series of events under the theme Contested Territories, which we've conceived and developed in collaboration with Chelsea College of Art and Design, our neighbours here at Millbank. These talks have included such participants as William Gibson, Barbara Kruger, Vanessa Beecroft, Arthur Danto, Griselda Pollock, Terry DeDuve, and Slavoj Zizek, to name a few. And tonight we have the pleasure of welcoming three more illustrious practitioners. We hope we have succeeded in programming a series of conversations between eminent thinkers, theorists, artists, writers, and practitioners, addressing everything from the idea of information to the premise of design. And tonight, we ask, what is the purpose of design? And we hope that these events have tackled those most pertinent of issues in contemporary practice today. We hope they've explored, and tonight, without exception, the things, spaces, and ideas that have shaped and developed the way we encounter art and the creative practices. The ambition and success in terms of both debate and audience, because every single event has sold out, would not have been possible without Chelsea. It is our collaborative aim to continue, we hope, this dialogue between ourselves and, of course, on stage with more contested territories. So may I thank Chelsea, and in particular, Roger Wilson, the former head, Linda Drew, the new head of school, and her colleagues, Sean Sterling and Sars Abaka. This evening, I have the great pleasure of inviting our chair and linchpin for this event, Dejan Sucek, who originally trained as an architect, yet his career has been based on a combination of writing, curating, and teaching. In 1983, he set up Blueprint and then subsequently worked as editor and editorial director on the magazine. He has taught at the University of Applied Arts in Vienna, was editor of Domus, has written for The Guardian, was architectural and design critic for The Observer, was visiting professor at the Royal College of Art, the dean of the Faculty of Art, Architecture and Design at Kingston University, and in 2002 was the director of the Venice Architectural Biennial. He has written numerous books and artist monographs, including Architecture and Democracy, Blade of Light, and The Edifice Complex, How the Rich and Powerful Shape the World. He's also written on John Parsons, Ron Arid, and Richard Rogers, to name a few. In March of last year, he took up the directorship of the Design Museum here in London. So without further ado, may I welcome and pass the floor to Dejan Sucek. Dejan?
Thank you. My role is to kick off this conversation and introduce the two people who are really the practitioners and are going to be doing the talking. But I thought I might just start off with a few thoughts about the question. It's rather an aggressive question, isn't it? What is the purpose of design? It sort of suggests that it needs to demonstrate that it has one, or that purpose might somehow be being questioned. And though in many ways design actually is at an extraordinarily fruitful moment, one could see why that kind of question might be posed. Design sometimes becomes rather a suspect sort of word. I remember picking up a Daily Mail before Christmas and finding a two-page spread in the middle which showed you designer fashions and how to get the same look for less, sort of implying that design is something which is a cynical manipulation which persuades people to buy things they don't necessarily need. At the Design Museum, it's a question that we are kind of wrestling with. You know, what is design in the context of a museum? And one can see different answers that really go back to 1851, the Victoria and Albert Museum, and the festival, and the Great Exhibition. And I suppose in those days, design was seen as, well, its purpose in terms of the exhibition and the museum was, in some senses, to instruct and to educate British manufacture that it was their duty to improve their products. In some ways to defend British industry from, in those days, Austro-Hungarian competition. And in many ways, of course, the same story is going on today, except the competition now seems to be Korea. And that definition of what design was as something that was an economic weapon, something which made industry more competitive, continues not at the V&A, but it's what informed the birth of the Design Council, and still lingers in a sense now, most recently, in the way that Gordon Brown, the Chancellor, has been taking up the idea of creative industries and the sense that we have 5 years left to save British design from that kind of lack of competitiveness. There's another very different view of what design might be seen, which I suppose goes back to the Museum of Modern Art in New York and its embrace of design as part of the idea of the modern museum back in the late 1920s. When design was admitted to the white spaces of an art museum, but only if it pretended it was art. So the museum accepted ball bearings as an exhibit, but presented it as if it were art, with the same sort of caption that you might find with a Leger painting of ball bearings. And maybe it's time to move on to see if there are other views of what design might be. So I guess today's conversation might be partly about that, but I'd like to begin with two people who I would imagine will be presenting what design is to them, what their design is, which is perhaps rather a different idea from the idea of design as purpose. We're going to start with Tom Dixon, who has had a number of careers, initially as a musician, I believe that's right, then as a designer maker, then as a designer, working with Habitat as a creative director, more recently as art director at Artec, the company established by Alvar Aalto. And I have to kind of warn you that Tom might be vanishing slightly before the end of the evening because he has to actually go to the Barbican where there is actually an exhibition of Aalto work opening this evening. But Tom, perhaps you'd like to begin.
You've said it all, Dan.
You bastard.
Switch me on.
So, unfortunately, I can see Ron's screen as well as my own.
I can do something.
Yeah, no,
you've
got, Ron's got a very slick designer presentation. I've got a crappy PowerPoint, but here we go. First, I introduce myself. I've tried every kind of design in the furniture industries that I could possibly think of. And as Dan suggested, I was never a proper designer at all.
No, I didn't suggest that at all, actually.
I was a musician. You know, I played bass guitar in a disco band. What design was for me was a hobby, and so my first excursions were really very much homemade. So, designers craft or designers as do it yourself. And I was lucky really not to go through an art school system or any kind of education in design because it left me free to define my own shapes and decide on my own rules. And so I learned design by probably making 50 to 100 chairs in my first year of welding practice. So this is the first type of chair. I had my first show at Ron's shop, one off, so we've had a long association. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that. Later on, I encountered the Italians and understood what design really was in terms of a value to industry, where the Italians had a very different attitude to design than all of British industry at the time, which would have been the early to mid 80s. And I encountered some of the better, more forward-thinking Italian furniture companies, and they made me understand through their love of all things design what it meant to them, which was really market share, increased value for their objects. And it taught me a lot about how designers could be valued as well. We had a very hard time getting anywhere to show or connecting with any industry in the UK in the 80s. But in Italy, we were greeted always at the airport with a sign and a small car, always taken to lunch. And design was a conversation as well as something intrinsic to their lives because they knew that that was the way they were going to compete worldwide. So the encounter with the Italians was fortuitous and taught me what I was, which was just about a designer by then because I'd learned how to make chairs. I got very frustrated with it because the difficult thing in working for others is making any money out of it, in the sense that designers are just a service to industries, and you get a very small proportion of the return on the cost of the object. Although you have fantastic lunches and you have fantastic quality of your products, it's virtually impossible to make a living from working as a service to many Italian firms, unless you strike lucky or unless you're phenomenally productive or you're particularly talented. So after several years of making things myself and working for the Italians, I decided it was time to take a job and try and learn design in a commercial environment. That's when I took a job at Habitat. And there I learned design in a completely different way, which was the retail type of design. Habitat is part of the IKEA group, so part of the biggest furniture company in the world. And so from going very high end with the Italians or making things myself in quite a tough environment, I was suddenly confronted with 6,000 items on the shop floor, of which 40% were turned over every year. So my maths...
It's a lot.
Quite a few. The idea of spending something, the budget ended up being, I was in charge of £1 million budget, but spreading design over 6,000 items, again, the maths, probably something like £40 each item a year on design. So from going from a space where design was very prized to a place where you had to be much more pragmatic about it, and then really the parts of design where you could make a difference were probably on the branding and on a very few of those items. But what was great about Habitat was the possibility of designing in all of the categories that nobody would have let me try before. So that could be toys, or that could be bathroom products, or that could be chairs, or that could be textiles, but a very broad range of things. So for me, it was the university of design there, so I could try almost anything. And a very different relationship with industry completely. So from going and begging people to make my stuff, I was suddenly in a position of power where my designs could be the answer to their turnover for the next few years. After a few years in the corporate sphere, I was dreaming of liberty again, so I decided to set up my own company. Still do some work for Habitat, but I now do design and try and do design in a very different way from most of the other designers, which is to try and work in companies that I part own. So I sold my own name, and so I'm now a corporation. No, what am I? I'm a part owner of my own name. And
which bit?
It's the proportion. It would probably just be the N at the end. I've decided that the in exchange for trying to get some funding, I'd be much more interested in being in a position where I could actually control a design company from a board level down. So this has been my decision, and so I run a company which manages two labels, one which is my own brand name, if you like, and the other one which is Artec, which is the modernist company that Alvar Aalto founded in 1935. So I've got an interesting and very different means of implementing design now, which is through controlling the commerce and the creation of objects as well. And so this is my new theory, is that designers should be much more in control of the means of and the process of production, and be in a position to take decisions at board level. Because if you work only as a service to industry, you find yourself always compromised, sometimes working not even with the managing director or the CEO, but working sometimes with the marketing people, working for motives which may not be your own. So that's my current state of design, is that I'm in a state where I believe that the best way of implementing design is to actually own the company. So we'll see if that one works. So the process of design management in Artek is to try and extract the DNA of the company, try and understand how you can move a company that's not had any product development for 60 odd years into a global and forward-facing company. So the work I'm doing at Artek at the moment is more to do with the innovating in materials, trying to find ways of working in new materials, rather than the process of making shapes, which is what you tend to do when you're working for other companies. So applying design to the whole chain of events that happen in a design-led company. So this is a chair which is made out of bent bamboo, which I think is probably the first use of this material in this way, which is something that we launched in Milan last year. So that's me and what I'm up to now. But I think, you know, if we're talking about what's the point of design, I think it's increasingly difficult to read. As you mentioned, it could be anything from fashion to graphics and the rest of it. And this is an advertising picture from an Italian furniture company. And you can see from that that, you know, what is design could be, at least in my sector, which is furniture, could be almost anything. I mean, it could be any colour. You know, there's no sense that there's a particular colour that's fashionable, not 1 year. It could be any style from Louis XIV to 60s and still be legitimate in any interior. So it's becoming increasingly difficult to read what design does, certainly in a style sense. And, you know, I'd like to think that design could get back to being something where it actually did have some kind of improvement in function. You know, I am nostalgic, maybe several thousand years back for a time when designers could actually make a difference by, you know, very simple actions. So that's my dream. I think, you know, sometimes the design that interests me would be, you know, to be involved in something properly innovative. I'm still, you know, seeking to break out of the chairs and lamps sphere into something that could be quite useful. This is an RB211 engine, which has got nothing to do with it. And I think, you know, there is some sectors of design at the moment which are, I mean, one of the big conversations which is going on is you know, can it be art as well? And so that's, you know, this chair is the one that everybody's talking about, the £1 million chair.
Mark designed by Tom.
No, not mine. No, Mark Newson's chair, and it's caused all kinds of people to you know, the art galleries to wonder whether design can be art and the rest of it. And I thought that's what we were talking about, but we're not. So we'll pass on Mark. And I think, you know, the current state of the world at the moment is very much that there's over consumption, as we know, there's overproduction of design, and you have to start wondering why you're doing it at all. These are pictures of China as it is now, and I think most companies that are commissioning design or most designers are really concerned about this, you know, the Asian part of things right now. And I think, you know, what's happening increasingly is we're designing more and more stuff, and it's becoming more and more cheap, and we're buying it because it's cheap and not because we particularly want it. So I've been thinking also about things of, you know, about how old-fashioned the furniture business is and how the distribution of it is so primitive in a way. The way that you warehouse things and the way that you commission them, you produce them in the Far East and so on and so forth. I'm trying to think of ways where I could actually design the business in a different way rather than design the chair at all. So, you know, thinking about how Google do their business, for instance, and say, right, okay, Google give away their core service completely for free. And wouldn't it be nice to try and do that for a change and give everything away for free? So in a bid for popularity last September, I did an experiment which was to try and just give away chairs for free, which caused me to be, you know, immensely popular to 500 people. And not at all to the rest of the queue that were waiting for the chairs in Trafalgar Square. And to try and think if there was cleverer ways to actually distribute furniture. Because if you're in the furniture business, it can be often a nightmare in terms of predicting what the customer will want, trying to understand what price they'll pay for it, putting massive investments in tooling to try and get the price at the correct level, commissioning stuff maybe a year in advance, So taking a big risk, sending it across the world and putting it in warehouses in the UK, and finding yourself in a position where you actually misjudge the colour, say, and it's not the fashionable colour of the moment, and having all of this stock left. The beauty of giving things away for free is that actually all of those things don't matter anymore. People just come and take them. But then you have to wonder, how what kind of business model that might be, because although it makes you reasonably popular, it's not a particularly great way of making money. Or could it be? See, there's a feeding frenzy here of people just grabbing chairs and not really. This is a person over here that was so keen, is trying to test out whether he can hold the chair on his head and cycle home at the same time. So I wished him luck. Yeah. So that's the tooling investment. And then, so the idea really, if you were to go down the Google route, would be that you could just sell the advertising on the chair. A fantastic way of getting an advertising message into people's houses for a long period of time, rather than doing it on a hoarding or in a 10-second television slot. And perhaps even get to the point where if you were lucky and people sat on the chair naked, you could actually brand your product into their bottoms. So that's on offer for anybody who wants to advertise at the moment. It's a possibility. Or potentially think of not selling your core, but selling the cover for it. So very much in the fashion business, saying, right, okay, I'm going to sell the carcass or give away the carcass of the sofa, but you're going to buy a fashionable cover for it every season. So I then get rid of all my distribution problems of trying to truck sofas to everybody's house because they've come and taken them away themselves. But all I'm doing is sending a cover through DHL to worldwide. So that's another fantasy of mine, that is I could actually give away the middle of the chair and just deal with the surface. And then maybe otherwise do a Mark Newson and sell $1 million chair out and give all the rest free. And so we've currently got one growing in an electrolytical bath, being plated in copper, with the intention of selling it for very expensive. So again, if there's anybody who's interested in the arts furniture market, I've got some things. I've got a couple of other projects if you want, or is it Ron's turn? Yeah.
I keep going.
Well, one thing that I did with Diane in Milan a couple of years ago was also to try and think about designing the process, and rather than designing the shape at all, just trying to think of a way of making things, which again was to do with liberating the customer and the seller of the objects from the big constraints that you have in producing furniture. So I think logically, in my experience in Habitat, the nightmares of predicting what people want and trying to stock a shop with that in the middle of the high street, a bit of a nightmare. IKEA kind of slightly better, where you actually get the customer to come and pick up their own furniture and you just get them to come to the warehouse, might be a good model. But it's still really quite old-fashioned. But the idea of getting people to come to the factory and actually make their own furniture was much more interesting to me. So the idea of maybe designing the factory to be a high street unit. So we didn't do high street, we did a Renaissance church in Milan, which was kind of nice, and set up the machine which I designed to remove the useful end, which is the tool, and just splurge out a spaghetti of plastic so that this plastic came out at a rate of a meter every 10 seconds, and that you'd had to deal with this hot material and actually weave it into an object, very much in a way that maybe a potter might make a pot or something, or a basket maker might make a basket. And so an idea of a sort of semi-industrial plant where you don't actually design anything, you just give people a set of different parameters that they can work within. Yes, you can have it any colour. You can have a different thicknesses or sizes of spaghetti or tagliatelle or fettuccine or whatever it is that you want the thing to be like. But you get the people to actually provide the labour themselves and take the thing home hot with the satisfaction of having made something themselves, which is something that not a lot of us get the opportunity to do, and then pay inordinate amounts of money to do so. So that was the proposition, and And so I think, you know, as an experiment, it worked very well and sort of showed the way to something that everybody talks about, which is sort of custom-made objects, which is the modern world as we see it, evolving. I mean, you know, it's clear now that it's, you don't need to do all of this fiddling about with the manual labour, although it was quite enjoyable to make chairs. So this is a chair that came out of it, because we're now in a position to just model things on the screen and grow them in Bath. So this is the reality now, and I think that probably that's quite a good segue into what Ron does, because he's done a lot more of that than I have. Yeah.
Tom, thank you. That was a fantastic range of things. And despite your protestations about business and management, everything that you talk about is about the pleasure that comes from making things or designing things. Ron Arad, I think, also became a designer, not by design. He was trying to be an architect and got sidetracked.
Not even that.
Well, you were studying architecture.
I did, but I didn't want to. I did study architecture because when I came to England, the AA, where I studied, seemed more like an art school than, oh yeah, that's a good idea. I was asked to prepare 10 images by the organizers, and I couldn't choose 10 images. So I had a brilliant idea. I'll have my screensaver running while I'm speaking. So this is my screensaver. And it's like an iPod shuffle. It just does it at random. Like, there's a design museum. I have to do a museum to accommodate everything Tom was talking about. And its content, which is chairs and things. But yeah, the AA in the 80s, was it 80s? I can't remember, like a long time ago, 70s, 74, when I came to London, seemed more like an art school than an architectural school. The reason is that no one was building anything in London, and if people did, they had to apologize to the mates that were busy being conceptual architects, being jealous of conceptual artists. And architecture was definitely on paper those days, you know, like Archigram, Bernard Tschumi before he discovered the corporate world, and, you know, a long list of architects. Then I did graduate somehow, and I realized that I'm not cut to work for other people, which is what you do when you study architecture. It's very difficult to work for other people, and it's very difficult to work for other people after lunch. So one lunchtime, I didn't come back to the office. And at that time, I had no idea that I'm going to become a designer. I went for a walk down Haverstock Hill. The office was in Hampstead, and I went down to the Roundhouse, where my office is now, and went to look for, look, I can do magic. I can leave the screensaver by touching any key here. Whoops. And
I wish you hadn't.
No, I want, you know, there's a long lecture here that I did somewhere else, but I won't bore you with it today because there's no time. I have some good news for you as well. The Rover chair, which is my first ever piece of furniture, which was a reclaimed car seat from a scrapyard in Chalk Farm that I put on a frame that was made out of tube and clamps that were designed for milking parlors in 1932 by someone called Gascoigne. I just made my first ready-made piece of furniture that I didn't know what I was doing then. I just thought, I'll choose a chair, I'll choose a car seat, and see what happens. And nothing happened for a long time. I had the screensaver again. This is a building. Hang on a second. Let's view it properly. Here it is, the Rover chair, 81. And I did two of them. I bought two two seats for £29 each and mounted them on this frame. Of course, drawing was very important those days. I made this innocent little sketch. And it lay dormant in my studio in Covent Garden for a long time until someone one Christmas day knocked on the door, and I said, I was in the studio, and I said, sorry, we are closed. And he said in a French accent, sorry, but I want to buy these chairs. And I said, ah, we are open. So he bought six chairs. At that time, I only made two ever. And he wanted six, and he gave us an address, gave me an address in Paris. I sold it for £99 at the time. Bought it for 29, sold it for 99. That was a very good profit. And he gave me a check, and after the holiday, when my partner Caroline came, said, oh, Jean-Paul Gaultier bought six Rover chairs. And I said, who is he? I don't think he knew who he was in 81 exactly. But after that, like by command, people started buying Rover chairs. And it's not because they have seen what he was buying. It was private, it wasn't for his. And this became, by our standards then, a best-selling piece. And we had to employ someone that with a van, and he employed people with vans, and they went up and down the country to all the scrapyards to retrieve the seats in any condition. We found some mortar trimmer in Kentish Town, Sid Phillips. He looked like Dracula. And he was sort of, he dropped every other job to do, and he did just Rover chair. And then when it got too successful, I decided to stop, declare the last 100. I think actually when a couple walked into the shop, having, you know, bought two chairs, and on the way out, the wife says to the husband, you know what I like about this chair? It reminds me a bit of a car seat. So I knew I did my job. And then people like Richard Rogers come, and then Dayan owned the chair. Do you remember? And you lent it to us for an exhibition, and we damaged it.
You damaged it?
We damaged it. It was torn, and it was bothering us in the storage space until Monday this week. We were talking years. Sid Phillips still exists, and he's repairing it for you, and you're going to get it.
You've made my week.
Thank you. Made your week.
Getting back to the
Yeah. Anyway, the. I've nearly finished. Anyway, so the first two I did were red, and I thought they're all red. But how wrong I was, because people will tell you that a red one that appears in an auction at Sotheby's or Christie's or Phillips is double the price of a black one for some reason. And then let's go back to the screensaver because it's a lot easier. I don't have to choose. I started doing furniture by hammering them, torturing them until they admitted that they are comfortable. And again, I made like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It gets boring, and boredom is the mother of creativity. So you move to other things. That was then, and luckily, London was a desert as far as design is concerned. There was no industry to go to with designs of cutlery or whatever, and say, how about that? There was nothing like that. Had I grown up or had I lived in Milan, I would do completely different things. But here in London, I had to invent my own profession. I'm desperately waiting for the screensaver, so it will come. I started by making things out of total ignorance. I didn't know anything about the design world, the design market. The last thing I was interested is the market, and business was always a necessary evil. And just when I started, there was the big VAT strike, and I didn't know I had to keep my receipts and stuff like that. And business did become a very evil necessary. And at that time, I sort of forgot about architecture for a while, and the chance to do architecture was designing my own studios. And then somehow I made, anything wrong? All right, thank you. I can induce it by, anyway. Somehow, from doing things out of ignorance for, and this is where I met Tom, when we were both ignorant. We were both ignorant together, that's how. I started making a sort of a name for myself in one field, which was furniture, if you could call it that. I don't think it was part of the furniture industry at any time. And then the furniture industry started to make approaches. You know, the biggest approach was from Vitra. I read in Diane's magazine, Blueprint, an article about the men who love chairs, Rolf Elbaum. Remember him? Hey, you, the lovely screensaver is back. And I just did one piece of furniture at that time, the Rover chair, and then interviewed Rolf Elbaum from Vitra, and he told him that this is the most interesting thing to come from London. That minute I became a designer.
I do remember you telling me about, wasn't it Documenta at Cassel, that you had a piece for that, and in the same day, Gagosian.
It was Bischofsberger, yeah.
Came around and saw the piece, and then an hour later, Felbaum from Vitra came around. And was that some kind of epiphany? Are you going to be an artist? Are you going to be a designer?
Yeah, I mean, actually, Rolf Elbaum came first. Rolf Elbaum was already good to me at the time because he invited me to do a piece for the Vitra edition, which was the well-tempered chair at the time. Again, I might go back to it, but maybe not, maybe some other. So I started having a rapport with Vitra that was sort of a rare example of an enlightened industrialist. As a kid, he used to go with his dad to America to translate Charles Eames and Nelson and people like that to his father, who couldn't speak English. And anyway, so Rolf Felbaum said, I want this piece. And I said, okay. And then he walked away. And then Bischofsberger was one of the most important gallerists in the world from Zurich, says, I want this piece. And I said to him, hang on a second, I talked to Rolf Elbaum now, another Swiss, and let me see what, and he said to me, now or never. And he had this word of money there, now or never. And it was never. But it was, that Documenta was a place where art actually had a physical battle with design. If you remember, what's the name of the curator? The German?
Fox?
No. Jutta Brandes and...
It'll come to you.
It will come to you. Anyway, Documenta decided to play with the idea that's been played in the world now is mix art and design. And they invited people like Alessandro Mandini, and there was, you know, all the design name were there, and they decided to mix it, to show design and art in the same room. Mandini, at that time, did hard-edged drawings, like black and yellow, and an artist called Lachia did a piece of art, which was a Mercedes, the latest Mercedes car on a turntable, which is a piece of design on a turntable. The designer Mandini shows black and white hard edge drawings on the walls. This guy, Lachia, walks into the room and says, what is this? I'm not going to have design in my room. And it developed into a physical fight between what's the name? Anyway, there was a fight between art and design, and I was there. I saw it. You know, it's just like
Volker.
Not Volker Albus. It will.
But you managed to keep out of the way of this fist fight.
I kept out of the way. I shared the place with Plessy, who did like, anyway. But I lost. I went with Vitra rather than with Bishopsberger.
But assuming that you had gone with the art dealer, would your life have been entirely different? Assuming that it had been a constructive relationship, would the work have been sold very differently? Would you never have done the kind of industrial production for Cartel, the kind of plastic extrusions by the mile?
Probably. I mean, probably.
I mean, you wouldn't be allowed to. And the dealer would not let you do that.
Probably, but I'm very, very glad I didn't, because I maintained the freedom to do what I always did, is do what I want, which is, you ask, like, what is the purpose of design? It depends at whose service. Sometimes you design things to attract attention. Sometimes you design camouflage. Sometimes you design life-saving equipment. Sometimes you design destroyers. I mean, it depends. So design is a dodgy word that doesn't really cover anything comprehensively or exclusively. I mean, for me, design is like designing a rotating, it's gun. It was a rotating restaurant in the Alps. Or a reception desk in a hotel in Rimini that doesn't look like other reception desks. Or to do design museums, or to do, what is this? This is a bar in the same hotel. And I don't really, this is that rotation. It has rotated a bit. This is in Stadt. This is a Mario Botta next to it. Or to do pieces of furniture that completely ignore the market because they are expensive because it's very expensive to produce. And later they have to be more expensive, to maintain that economy. Or public sculpture, or to do like showrooms for Yoji Yamamoto in Tokyo. That same bloody chair again. Somehow, not going with Bruno Bishopsberger allowed me the freedom to do bookshelves for Cartel that extrude over 1,000 kilometers every year, as we speak. And to do things that are sort of so impractical and so anti-common sense and business-like and so irresponsible, in other words. I mean, there's no way to justify this as a little thing to put your bum on 40 centimeters of the floor. And it allows you to play with buildings in a way that is totally irresponsible, and to fight the authorities, pretend it is responsible. Unlike Tom, I didn't subscribe to the commercial, to serving the commercial world, and which is, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's just very debilitating to design something and to then discuss with the Italian industrialist whether it should be made smaller so he can sell more. Sometimes a chair has to be, or a piece of furniture has to be that size, even if it means selling less. I mean, the market is not, although the market is very interesting, and it's sort of fueling a lot of things. You know, all the irresponsible things I'm doing are part of some economy that somehow works.
How do you know which is a good irresponsible piece as opposed to a not so good irresponsible piece?
If you surrender to, or you submit to some preoccupation, and you find it interesting enough, you do it. Sometimes you win, and other times you win. And sometimes, this is a rug, by the way. And this is a swimming pool on top of a building that looks too much like a David Hockney I can see now. And this is a silicone chair with a skeleton that says there's no solution because there's no problem, which is not true, by the way. I mean, and it says that it's made in England on the English side, and it says fabriqué en France on the other one, which is a lie, not only irresponsible. And somehow the limited edition of six of them, because you don't want to do seven, because it's too boring to do seven, you want to do other things, is sold out before it's made. It's not my fault, but I enjoy it.
But I guess working in a gallery context does actually have exactly the same kind of disciplines that working for one of those Italian industrialists who wants smaller pieces rather than bigger ones. There are rules about an art market, just as there are rules about a design market.
Well, it's up to you how much of it you obey, and how much you want to serve it, and how much. Look, I mean, it's not that I don't want to follow the rules; I just don't know how. It's just I never did, and I think everything I do is the result of not being able to do what I'm supposed to do. I mean, it's like, I think if I grew up now in school, I would be spotted as special needs, and they would have cured me, and we would have none of this.
And you'd be the art director at Habitat.
No, I don't. I wouldn't say that.
Is there something? But I mean, I guess to me, the difference between design and other things, if you can make categories, is that it tends to be, first of all, there's a space between the kind of the drawing bit or the thinking bit and the making bit, and then usually there's more of them than there are with. There's something about the numbers, and the idea of making an object which becomes as universal as a telephone or a laptop is a sort of different kind of activity or a different kind of narcissistic pleasure than making a very beautiful thing.
It is, but it's not. It's not like it's not one or the other, and it's not. You're not neurotic. You know that if you invest in tooling that costs that much, the fruit of the tool has to cover at least the tooling and the people around it and the factories. And there's a great pleasure in coming up with products that actually work well and serve.
Well, those early pieces, you know, found, salvage, collage, seem to be about. You can't afford the tools. You can't aspire to the kind of the glossy values that come from a machine. So you imitate them, or you find ways of paraphrasing them.
It is the question of survival and doing what you can do. But what training it gives you is you can do things without constantly negotiating with other people. And sometimes negotiating, when you do architecture, there's no escape. I mean, don't do architecture for yourself. You have to have a client. You have to have someone that asks you to do this. This is the brief here. I want the most beautiful building in Tel Aviv. Right, okay, here it is. And it has to please the firemen. It has to please UNESCO that declared Tel Aviv a Bauhaus center. And it has to, and don't go there if you're not prepared to negotiate, or if you don't, because you won't win.
But there's something about the weight that comes from function or purpose or brief that seems to be a kind of starting point more than a handicap.
Well, it's both. It's both. I mean, there are necessary conditions to make a piece of furniture a piece of furniture. For a start, you know, crudely, it has to be comfortable. If it is to be sat on, I mean, or reasonably comfortable, or whatever, it has to have something about it that is that makes it a furniture. Otherwise, it's just a lump of sculpture, which could be fantastic. It's not, but there's no rules. I mean, every project, everything you do has to have enough things to justify why it gives you pleasure in designing it, in going through the pain of having it made, and for other people to actually want it. And it's always there. I mean, the negotiation is always there, even though it's not always done face to face. You know, what if you do a party and no one turns up? What if you do a gallery show and there's no interest in it? And then that's also a sort of a negotiation. But
Tom, you did a lot of negotiation, or less than you used to. I mean, what you began with seemed to be very much about the personal pleasure that you took in making things.
Yes.
And can you do more by working with...
Can I have more pleasure by doing more things?
Or is it a different kind of pleasure from having things made in large numbers with lots of other people involved?
Well, I can always go back to making one or two things, but you know, what interests me now is trying to do larger things which are impossible without some degree of infrastructure and support and backing and so on and so forth. I mean, so it's, you know, I can still do furniture as a hobby and enjoy that, but I think that I'm interested in how you do things better and differently and at the moment a bit bigger than I could do on my own.
And the Artex story, it seems to be an extraordinary, well, you're following in the footsteps of someone who had a sense of high moral purpose about what design might be, about saying something about the essence of Finland and the country, and technology was full of the sorts of things that designers tend not to talk about these days.
Yeah, it's getting increasingly difficult to have a sense of moral purpose if you're involved in conspicuous consumption of more furniture that people don't really need in the West, you know, and I think that...
Furniture is blameless by comparison. I mean, digital cameras that last 8 months, you know, product cycles become shorter and shorter. Laptops become, you know, a year and a half if you're lucky.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in Artec we're trying to think of some degree of justification, at least in the sourcing of the materials, in the longevity of the products, in their actual value, rather than their perceived value, and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, there's an interesting instance, which is that IKEA do produce an Alvar Aalto stool, which is £8 or £7, I think, now, and we sell the original for £80. And so you'd think, well, there's no market for an Alvar Aalto stool anymore, but there is a perceived quality there. And
they do the very same design.
It's slightly different in its method of manufacture, but it's exactly the same design. It's a total rip-off. One of my ambitions is probably to sue.
Can we have the screen for a second? I don't know why I lost it. Is it... Is there anyone...
Technical help?
Anyone listening here?
I'll describe it very carefully.
Describe it. What do you see?
I see some chair prototypes.
No, they're not prototypes. Oops. Ah, I can all see it. This is my visit in China. I went to see a factory that employs 300 people that I never negotiated anything with, and they make my chairs, all copies, and you don't have to go to IKEA. You can buy it for £10 and. Or you can buy it for £300. Make your choice. They just buy one and clone it. And that's actually where the future of manufacturing is, I think. And they do it too. This is Charles Eames inside his bags. And there was a Panton. Did you see? This is a lorry full of Eames aluminium chairs. And this is, by the way, the only factory in the world that I saw people work in the production, like sitting on the swiveling Charles Eames chairs. You don't see it in Italy. And here it is. He's making his own chair. And Pantones. And a photographer. I mean, before I went to visit them, they called the person that organized it, asked, should we hide all of Ron Arad's chairs before his visit? I said, no, that's exactly what he wants to see. And we're all up against this, you know, just like, and it's a quiz, you know, well.
Jorge Pensi,
Amat, you must be a journalist. and this
that's
was
a
the
fake
fear.
Ron Arad.
It's not, this is one they bought in Vitra. So you think, is this the next victim? And then we had a discussion with them. And I reassured them that even though I'm not sure what I think about them, because this guy here, Bill, I'm sure he has another name as well, but he's called Bill. he does an MBA studies after work. Instead of holidays, he goes and learns. It's all about bettering themselves. And there's 300 people just, you know, working there, just punching. It's totally surreal, incredible. And I told him, let me reassure you, you might be doing good things here. I didn't know if I'm upset or not. But let me reassure you that the people in Europe that flog your stuff are not nice people. You know, they're not good people, and you know, have no problem fighting them. And I'm starting to see if we can take this factory and win them of copies by organizing some designers like Tom and other people to give them original designs. If they use the same technology, the same energy, and clever, they're very clever, to produce original design, then why should they do copies? And Vitra, as we said, very intellectual, very enlightened owner, is willing to take part in a project like this because they'll also benefit from a company like that moving from copying.
Makes you think what would happen if they turn their attention to Jeff Koons' balloons or...
Yeah, I mean, everything is possible. There's, in their office, there's a poster of Vitra and Frank Gehry's building, and Herman Miller, and Apple, and Nike, no shame. And and when I say no shame, it's not like, I don't accuse them of no, there is no shame. I mean, it's as simple as that. And they have catalogs and websites. My name's not mentioned there once. It's called New Products, which could be my new name. And it, you know, that's what they do, you know, just like. And I know there's this guy, this friend of mine from Hong Kong, could direct me to 11 companies in China that make the Vitra Tomvac chair of mine. And you're helpless, but there's sort of, and when it's a long time ago, it's like 2 months since I've been there, I thought I'm going to go back and this is going to be my campaign, and I almost forgot about it now. Thanks for reminding me. But that is the problem of Italy, by the way, because Italy is not so hot on design now. It still has a very good manufacturing tradition. But for some reason, where we had in the 50s and 60s, we had Italian maestri. Where are they now? All the people that design for the Italian industry come from England, from France, from all over the world, not from Italy. And now they're going to lose manufacturing. Who knows what's going to happen? You look worried. Did I say something that...
No, I'm just wondering whether design actually does have a future, really. It's, is design just something which happened at one particular historical moment and was the product of a particular kind of manufacturing in Western Europe, and maybe now the world is about something else and that we are still living on the kind of...
I mean, look, we are sitting here in Tate Britain and we're talking about design and art, and look what we're sitting on.
Well, we're sitting in a fantastic postmodern space designed by James Sterling and sitting on chairs designed
by Ron Carter.
Ron Carter.
But is this, I mean...
Time changes fast, but...
But not fast enough.
I quite like these chairs, actually.
You're like, okay, you're not getting your rover back.
Tom, are you an optimist about this? Mm-hmm.
Well, there's something fundamentally wrong, but things are changing very quickly in a way that they never have before. In my memory, anyway. I mean, clearly, that you know what I was talking about was the possibility that everything doesn't have to be produced in China. I think that there will be a premium on materials, meaning that people won't be able to afford things that they previously bought as a disposable. So things are not static, and so the design has got a future in tackling some of those intrinsic things. I think that we need to get slightly away from the obsession with just making new shapes for the sake of it, which is the big danger, given that now it's possible suddenly to produce anything at all in any shape, any of the fantasy shapes that you could produce on your computer screen, you can just print out now. So there's a big danger that ends up in being exactly what we do with photocopiers now, which is just to knock out any amount of paperwork, but we do it in three dimensions, and that the whole world fills up with lots and lots of crazy new shapes that don't particularly have a function or a reason for existing. But in a better scenario, you end up with a lot of design-aware people that are applying their minds to real problems that need to be solved right now. And there's quite a few of those around, right?
It's interesting you showed the RB211 engine, which of course was designed by about 800 people. And maybe some of the most interesting things about design are the ones that do actually reflect the effort that comes from lots of people thinking about something.
Yeah, that would be great. Let's do that. I think I think there's some big, big problems, and you know, some of us, and I include myself, are fiddling at the edges of it. I very much enjoy what I do, and I think that sometimes, you know, as I showed before, that maybe there is more the design of the system or the system of delivery or thinking about the whole chain of manufacturing process and that can be designed as well. I think we concentrate far too much on the final object and the personality behind it, but that's fine by me at the moment.
We have to be careful when we talk about useful things, because the whole thing, everything, I think not a single thing you have seen today is useful. It's all surplus to requirement. But we shouldn't panic, because culture is surplus to requirement. When you're hungry, you'd eat anything, and when you're not hungry and there's like things around you, you begin to worry about salt and pepper and other spices, and that's where culture begins. If you are starving or if you are drowning, you shout, help. If you have more time, you say, help me if you can, I'm feeling down, and it becomes poetry and culture. Mm-hmm. But it's everything we dealt with today is surplus to requirement. Nothing of the things I've ever done is sort of essential to anyone, by any stretch of the imagination, except, but you can say that about, is there next week, is there a conference about what's the purpose of photography? What's the purpose of poetry? What's the purpose of art? You know, there is a purpose, you know,
Photography actually, of course, 20 years ago, it went through a leap where it stopped being about representation and passport photographs and became something.
It didn't stop. I mean, We still have photographs on our passports. We still have pictures on the front page of the Sun and on the third page of the Sun. And it's still there. And at the same time, there's like Cindy Sherman and Gursky and Thomas Rupp and people that, and let people argue to death whether Helmut Newton was an artist or a photographer. I mean, it would be a boring debate. What's the purpose of photography?
I was trying to avoid that, but.
And I think it's equally boring. What's the purpose of design? None.
But at the same time, everything.
I mean, for me it is, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just it's what we do. You know, it's. What's the purpose of ballet? You know, it's like.
Well, it's interesting. If you're trying to run a design museum, it's a question that you have to sort of try and provide slightly more coherent answers. And you know, I find myself thinking, well, Tate Modern reflects the world around us through artists' responses to it. And the curator's voice is hardly there. It's, you know, to explain art, you know, is the kind of the most embarrassing thing you could possibly do on the wall of a gallery. Whereas I suppose a design museum has to try and explain how something is made, or a process, or why, or the things it's made with.
How does a gun work? I mean, it's very interesting. There's like,
a gun.
It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, but
well, I mean, guns are very. I mean, they're about modernism because they were kind of made in mass production, modular. Also, they kind of can reflect emotions. They can look fierce. They can look high tech.
A gun for every worker. Well, sorry, a gun for every high school student. I mean, it's
moving right along, but in a design museum, how something is made is rather important. How one of Kunz's pieces is made is not something that is part of the kind of conversation.
I think it is. You know, I think it is interesting how a Jeff Kunz piece is made.
Well, I think it is very interesting, but it's not something that's talked about. There is a factory in what was East Germany producing those pieces, and they're the same kind of values that we judge design by. How well is something made? You know, is a complicated question to answer. What are the things that we actually think of as well made? You know, shiny, not shiny, dented, apparently perfect. I mean, they're kind of very much the values of production. But you don't talk about it. A conversation like the way we started today, with you talking about how, you know, it's revealing things that maybe an art conversation wouldn't do.
It depends what, you know, like when I visit, I don't know, let's go for my nearest neighbor, Anthony Gormley. I mean, we always talk about how things are made. That's the kind of conversation we have. And I'm always amazed how much, where were you? I mean, you know, like you make things. The conversation is there.
In public?
For people that maybe it's not so interesting. Maybe it's not, I don't know. Is it interesting how things are made?
Well, when you're running Domus, you have to show how things are made because otherwise you get bored to death with pictures of glossy chairs that have been finished, whereas the tool that makes the chair is actually in itself rather a beautiful thing.
When you see a floss light with a golden Kalashnikov by Stark, are you interested in how it's made?
Is that not. No.
No, okay. Sorry?
You mean whether it's a real gun, spray painted, or a plastic gun?
How it's made, or when you see a big horse holding a lampshade at Mui, I mean, you want to see how it's made? Or when you see, I don't know, some things provoke you to know how they're made, and some things are not. And sometimes the most interesting thing about a piece is how it's made. This is actually a blown aluminium, and that's how the ball is made. Very interesting for some people, but I don't assume that most people should be interested in it. Even if they go and see the same bubble in a design museum, they should, you know, I don't care about what exactly did Giacometti mix in his clay. Why should I? I am if I'm in the business of making stuff like that. But it's interesting attempt to define design, that, you know, design, we're interested in how it's made, and art, not.
Well, one partial kind of approach to that. Yeah. And, you know, there are other things, obviously, but.
I mean, there are all sorts of attempts, like, you know, art cannot be useful. And then there's attempts to do just the opposite. Take a Rembrandt and make an ironing board out of it. And take, that's Duchamp, make it useful. Let's see what happens if you take art and make it useful. I don't know, I think there's...
Well, as we know, Warhol began as an illustrator. And how do you stop being an illustrator and become an artist? Because you say you are, or the way you perform?
Because
things you talk about?
Because of the body of work and what you did, and also what you said, and where you went, and who you talked to. And after years and years, you look at the Warhol exhibition, And you say that he was a bloody good painter.
He was a very good illustrator too.
He was, you know, whatever painting is a. It's not just the story. It's not. I mean, like I think I don't know. If, shall we talk about? If you go to Pollock, for example, I think the most interesting thing is his departure from the easel to the floor, from the brush to drawing it. And me personally, when I look at the canvases, I mean, they're less thrilling than the gesture itself. They're less thrilling than how it was made. How it was made was very liberating, very thrilling. And with Warhol, I know it was made like mechanically by silk screens, but you look at, you know, you look at a room full of them, or me being conditioned, being, you know, growing up in the 60s, I think, you know, they're amazing pieces, amazing like canvases. But I mean, but it's only one person's opinion.
Well, you're on the platform this evening.
Ah, sorry.
I think we're kind of running towards the end of the evening, but if there are any questions from the floor, I'd be happy to take some. Do you want to think about it?
Take the liberty while I'm standing here with the mic before I pass it. And it's really a question for Tom. I'm quite interested in a lot of what Ron was saying, but felt it was very oppositional, contested, to some of the points you were making. And for me, as a kind of general punter, wandering into Habitat in the 90s, late 90s, was an incredibly liberating experience. And felt
what was liberating? Sorry,
well, just the possibility of having both function and beauty in that kind of really cliched classic way, but having it accessible, and the democratization, for want of a better word, of that. And I'm wondering, with that sort of shift in the marketplace and obviously a general rise in social consciousness, whether you now feel designers have a different sorts of responsibility in terms of ethics or morals, and how you place yourself in that. I guess the idea of a responsible designer or...
Well, it's becoming a bigger and bigger conversation that people have all the time. I don't think anybody's really investing enough time or effort into it from an industrial perspective. I don't think that the 90s was the time when it happened at all. I think the 60s was the time when design became democratic, and, you know, when plastic was cheap and available, and social, you know, social habits were changing in terms of how they entertained or how they were prepared to sit. I mean, that must have been a very exciting time that I completely missed. The 90s was just another kind of consumer boom of some sort, I think, not informed by new technologies or new ways of living at all. So I think the 90s was pretty dismal to a certain extent. And I see now, like I say, a complete change in the potential of manufacturing, given the integration of the virtual world into proper industrial bases now. It's happening right now, it's happening very rapidly. And also a very big shift in people's attitudes towards, or the beginnings of a shift in attitude to people's understanding of how their actions in consumption affect the way they're going to live in the future, right? And I think, you know, to a certain extent, it's the two biggest subject to talk about if we're talking about, you know, art and design kind of thing. And those things will become potentially peripheral if we're to believe the doomsday scenarios that are being painted for us every day on the front of the newspapers or the television. I mean, it's a terrifying world out there. You know, you've got to believe the 70,000 graduates that are studying design now in the UK.
Is this a good number?
Apparently, 70,000 a year pumped out of, that they're going to find something more useful to do than just nourish Chinese industry with a lot of fantastic new shapes that they can create ad infinitum on their computers. And so maybe Diane's scenario of 800 people working together to solve a real problem might be quite an interesting possibility, because we've got quite a lot of brains out there that are not exercising them in the design world. But I do see a change now in certainly in the landscape, for sure. You know, there's massive shifts going on, and I think it's a bit too early to judge how designers are going to deal with that. Is that... I've forgotten your question, but...
It was a very responsible answer.
So Ron's doing irresponsible today.
Good guy, big guy.
Hand over here.
I've spent an amount of time in Lagos and in India last year, and it's clear to me that you can't do that in a part-time hobby kind of way. You know, if you're going to commit to improving things in Lagos, you've got, you know, several lifetimes to invest in just doing that to see a proper return. So yeah, I'm dead interested in it. I've got a few views on it, and I'll be doing a little bit more of it, but I'm not sure that I'm able to invest several lifetimes in it right now.
Hand at the back.
Design one item which would make a difference.
I think, you know, to be offered a project like that would be extraordinary. I mean, you've got to remember that I was a self-initiated project by an engineer, inventor, which is kind of a great thing.
And Rob?
I wish I had designed the wind-up radio, but I didn't. That's not what I do. I mean, I'm like Tom, I have views, and I have views about the world problems, but I don't think that my profession is the best situated to solve them. I mean, I confronted something in China that touches me, and I want to do good there. I mean, I don't want to call the police with the dogs to close the factory. I want to find a different solution. What it means, I don't even know. I don't know if what the little good I'm trying to do is any good at all. But I'm just an entertainer. I'm not a do-gooder.
A question for Ron. I said, and I've bought some objects at Alessi, the Shaker, or Ronarat Shaker, and I've noticed that you're really into curvaceous forms. Curve is very important, and I've seen also your screen say that most of your projects or objects or work of arts are based on the concept of curves, very curvaceous, very feminine. Why do you usually go down this route?
You have, the answer is, as a man, I'm not afraid of curves. But I think a straight line is also a curve. It's the shortest curve between two points. And sometimes you'll find that I do use straight lines. And in the case of your shaker, I'll explain to you why it's twisted like that. When you shake ice in a shaker, it has to hit things. And if it just hits the floor and the ceiling of the shaker, it breaks the ice in, you know, that slow. But once it's twisted, the ice has no choice, you know, no future, it just breaks. And the form here actually is, this is a post-rationalizing, of course, you know, telling lies, but it's there. I mean that I do use curves, yeah. I confess.
Mr. McDonald in the back.
Hi, Nico McDonald. one of the on this question that was outlined in the introduction to the event of designers refusing to produce multiples and the blurring of boundaries between design and art. I was reflecting on a comment that Tom made on an interview on Radio 4 a few years ago, a program called Between Ourselves, where he talked about, with Kenneth Grange, loving the idea of designing things that people would use every day. And that seems to be a sort of decreasing sentiment among designers. We've talked a bit about designing for the third world, and there's a contention that we've got too much stuff in the first world, whereas actually I think most people in this world, apart from perhaps people in this room, don't have too much stuff, and there's lots of really interesting things that we could design for people to make their lives better. I came here on an underground train that was 25 minutes late. You know, I think maybe we need to redesign London transport to start with. You know, housing, there are all sorts of things where there are really interesting design challenges, and I just wonder if there's a a sort of diminishing sense of humanism, not perhaps captured certainly by Tom's comment, among designers, that means actually they're less interested in designing for, you know, real people in the real world and more interested in designing, you know, singles and things which are more experimental and more sort of distant from the real world? Or am I sort of making up this phenomenon?
Who are you asking?
Well, I think I'm asking you particularly, Tom, because your comments
I think everybody would be very, very happy to be asked to do that kind of project. Those kind of offers come very, very, I mean, I've never had one, basically. You know, you ask me to design a tube train, I'd be delighted, thank you, or a tube map, or anything that people use every day. I think as industry gets bigger and more distant, you know, and the stakes get higher in terms of firms being global players and being able to make things super cheap, then it becomes harder and harder for them to make the decisions to commission radical design. And I think a big part of the problem lies also with the lack of government commissioning. You know, I did, you know, rant on to a government select committee about the fact that there is no new route master. We're buying buses from God knows where. I think Germany. And you know, the chance to design something like that would be a joy for any designer. I don't have the background to make me a particularly great bus designer, but, you know, I think that there's no lack of humanity. And these questions, these kind of questions about, you know, working in the third world, doing design that touches people every day, doing proper industrial design, come up all the time, you know, from design students, from academics, you know, from journalists and the rest of it. It's obviously out there, but I think it's, you know, that there are very, very few offers to actually do that kind of thing. And I think me and Ron have kind of pushed ourselves into a space where we're seen as more fashion designers to a certain extent than serious industrial designers. Ron's done a lot more industrial design than me, but I've been victim of my own wish to be self-propelled and make my own things. So route master bus doesn't really fit into that category of things I can make myself or get made.
You know? And on that shameless bid pitch for more work from the audience, I think we should
go. I've got a party to go to.
And it is 8 o'clock. So Tom and Ron, thank you both for being here.
Can I just reiterate and thank Ron and Diane and Tom for joining us this evening? And can I thank all of you for joining us? And may I offer you a drink? Please do continue the conversation. Thank you.
Deal with the Sotheby's exhibition once it finishes.
Well, we have a very nice design for it. What are you going to take to my thrift?
We're working big balls, blown.